This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University professor Chris Whelan says the way the nation cares for older people at home hurts women economically.
Women who have historically had the greatest responsibility to provide this care, often they are either cutting back on school or work or leaving work early in order to provide the care at home.
Whelan talks about a new book on critical gerontology. Plus, a lawsuit against Illinois State University comes from the accused in a sexual misconduct case. Ryan Denham talks about Title IX issues regarding that. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A new lawsuit accuses Illinois State University of mishandling an investigation of sexual misconduct involving a student, but it's not the victim filing the suit, it's the accused. A former student claims ISU violated his due process rights and suspended him from campus over allegations that were eventually proven false. His lawyers claim ISU's investigation showed a bias against male students and that no criminal charges were ever filed against him. The lawsuit seeks more than $1 million in damages. The lawsuit comes as college campuses across the country adjust to new guidance from the Federal Education Department about how to handle sexual misconduct cases, also called Title IX cases. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke to John Doe's lawyers, Brenda Bukowski and Mark Johnson, about the case. Bukowski says there are big differences between Title IX cases and criminal investigations.
In a criminal proceeding, one has a right to confront their accuser. The burden on the state's attorney when proving a charge is beyond a reasonable doubt. We all know that. That's in our Constitution. But you have a right to cross-examine witnesses, to call witnesses on your behalf, to see the reports that are been generated in relation to the case. And with Title IX proceedings, basically, virtually none of that is true. An individual has a right to see reports, but I can't tell you how many Title IX hearings we've attended and beaten successfully, despite the fact that they've only shown us a couple of the 10 that might be out there, for example. Then at the actual hearing, it was under the Obama administration that the rules of evidence changed. So at a criminal case, not only do you see the reports, but in addition to the reports, you get to ask those questions. You can't just admit a report in a criminal case. At a Title IX hearing, the rules changed so that you can just literally submit a written report that can be hearsay, that wouldn't otherwise be allowed in a court of law. And then that means there's no opportunity to call and cross-examine a witness who might be testifying against you, because it's a narrative report that's being filed and considered as evidence, despite the fact that it's written by somebody, by a third party, like a police officer. And it's entirely different than a criminal proceeding altogether. In criminal proceedings, it's all about guaranteeing the accused right to a fair trial. And frankly, the way that Title IX hearings have progressed, it seems like that's the farthest from having a fair hearing is the farthest thing from anybody's mind.
Can you talk about the differences in burdens of proof from beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a concept I think a lot of folks are familiar with from literally any movie or TV show, and then the preponderance of evidence theory, which is sort of at the root of the Title IX hearing process?
Absolutely. In a criminal case, the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's actually not defined under Illinois law. You're not allowed in criminal cases to tell a jury what beyond a reasonable doubt means. Other states, that's not true. Preponderance of the evidence is commonly referred to as being 51% likely. It just has to be more likely than not that something happened. And that's essentially the one of, or arguably the lowest civil burden that there is. I say arguably only because there is such a thing as strict liability, where you just ask if an event occurred, period. But as far as an actual burden of proof, the preponderance of the evidence is that low standard of 51%. 1% likely. That's a way that most people understand it. Whereas beyond a reasonable doubt often equates to, are there reasonable doubts? Literally what the words mean in the state of Illinois.
What can you tell me about your client? You filed this lawsuit under anonymity, so that he's referred to as John Doe in the suit. But what can you tell me about him and how he was affected by this more specifically?
We went ahead and filed the lawsuit with a motion to proceed under pseudonyms, meaning that the confidentiality of the individual is very, very important, not only for our former ISU student, but there are actually two female ISU students, and their identities should be protected as well. So in getting to that question, we did file the suit under pseudonyms. And we did that for various obvious reasons, and that's to protect their confidentiality. Our guy, great guy. He did 4 years at ISU. Had a good time here. Studied very well. Was very proactive. Never disciplined in any way, shape, or form. Since being suspended from ISU and subsequently having to withdraw from the university, he's now working very menial jobs in comparison to where he would be in life had his college not been disrupted by Illinois State University. So we're hoping he can recover. That certainly is the goal for us fathers, for all of our sons, and that's our goal in this particular case as well.
And was he able to finish his degree at another institution?
No, he was not. He's had some great difficulties in transferring to other universities to the caliber of Illinois State University, based upon the fact that he was suspended, caused to fail ISU one semester, and then not able to move on with his classes the next semester. So the ramifications were pretty hard. It's been some time, and he's still not been able to be accepted into a college.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here in studio with Mark Johnson and Brendan Bukowski, two lawyers who filed a lawsuit against Illinois State University on behalf of their client John Doe over ISU's handling of a Title IX investigation. Last fall, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos kicked off an effort to reform how the federal government advises colleges and universities about how they handle sexual misconduct. She said, among other things, that the old guidance from the Obama administration was unfair to those accused of sexual assault. Critics are worried the process will roll back protections for victims of sexual assault. Brendan, how does your lawsuit connect to the concerns raised by DeVos?
I think that our lawsuit helps highlight some of those concerns, quite frankly. I think that during the Obama administration, they sought to, if you will, relax a lot of the standards that people were held by, that the administration was held by in performing or conducting that Title IX hearing. I think some of the measures or some of the discussions that that have been had in relation to Title IX under DeVos have talked about making them more strict, affording people more due process rights. And frankly, that's something that all of us should be able to get behind, the ability to have more rights, not less. And that's what we're really talking about. I think our suit highlights what the natural consequences of a loosening of the rules results in, and versus what might have been or what could be if people were granted more rights, more right to due process and to have a fairer hearing.
Well, as you can imagine, Illinois State University is not wild about talking pending litigation in the media, right? So they're not going to say a lot at this point. I think their argument would probably be, though, that they were in a tight spot, right? They have a bunch of students on a college campus together, one makes an accusation against the other. You know, you don't want those students running into each other. You don't want them sharing the same space. They're concerned they would lose federal funding if a victim has a Title IX experience that is unsatisfactory. They're concerned they would be investigated. So they would make that argument that they're in a tight spot and they don't have a lot of good options. What, in your view, would have been a better way to handle your client's case?
No, ISU is clearly in a tight spot, and they have been put in that tight spot by way of the directives from the Obama administration. So they were required to take certain measures which have been unfair from our perspective. But in this particular case, we believe that when we showed Illinois State University the evidence which exculpated our client, they should have put the skids on their investigation. They should have put the skids on the interim suspension and the sanctions that were imposed on our client. And yeah, Ryan, we understand ISU is in a difficult situation with the political landscape as it is, but we're looking at it in a certain way. We would like for ISU to understand that they need to make some substantial changes in the way that they're bringing these charges and the proceedings and the investigation and the ultimate adjudicatory hearing.
And they can make changes prior to formal guidance, a new Dear Colleague letter or something else coming down from the Department of Education?
Yeah, in September of 2017, Betsy DeVos, who's the Secretary of DOE, Department of Education, she and Candace Jackson issued a new Dear Colleague letter. And that Dear Colleague letter has given a lot of new guidance, a lot of new directives, but that just happened in September of 2017. So public universities, universities that are private but get federal funding, you know, they're going to need some time in order to put these new systems into place. It's not been put into place that we're aware of on the local level as we sit here today, but we're hopeful that ISU will get the message in this particular case, make those necessary changes in order to not victimize or deny our youth their rights to due process as they go through the college administrative proceedings.
And in response to your question about them being able to do things the way that they want to do things, I can tell you that we've attended ISU hearings at all kinds of different schools, and you'd be amazed at how different the process is school to school.
I mean, you mean to say that you've attended Title IX hearings at all different?
Well, we've represented individuals who've been subject to Title IX hearings and been in attendance at them. We're not allowed to participate under the current rules, or at least the way that the universities do that. But the observations we've made for one school versus another school versus another school, still subject to the same Dear Colleague letter, is pretty remarkable and stark. That said, the issue, I don't think, is should a university investigate anything? Should a university take a complaint as serious? I think certainly the answer to that question is absolutely yes, they should. In this instance, ISU had received information that the complainant had lied, and it was not in a person's opinion, it was words, that individual's words in writing, and it was still pursued. And the ISU doesn't necessarily have to hold a Title IX hearing, doesn't necessarily have to make somebody subject to that hearing. They do receive complaints all the time. This was an incredible complaint, and then our client went through this process, and following that, all of the fallout because of that. And this was something that, whether because of lending to the political winds or, you know, being afraid of what, you know, a complaint might be. But honestly, I take your point as well made in relation to the fact that somebody could make a complaint against ISU as far as their handling of a matter. The problem is that in this instance, the information they had received demonstrated that this was a false allegation and they didn't need to pursue it, but they did.
Mark, how do you think this lawsuit and Betsy DeVos's calls for reform will impact other college campuses in addition to ISU?
No, it's a very challenging area right now, Ryan. We're hopeful that universities throughout the country, throughout the state of Illinois, take heed to the new directives that the Trump administration is putting into play so that due process and constitutional rights are not violated in the future. That's the goal here. The goal is that everyone is able to have their rights and that those rights not be violated.
That's Mark Johnson and Brendan Bukowski, two lawyers who filed a lawsuit against Illinois State University on behalf of their client, John Doe, over ISU's handling of a Title IX investigation. I'm Ryan Denham.
In a statement, ISU says it couldn't comment on pending litigation, but the university says it's responsible for complying with all federal, state, and civil rights laws. The university says it takes this responsibility seriously and has related university policies that ensure a fair, thorough, and impartial investigation into allegations of discrimination and harassment. With respect to sexual misconduct allegations, ISU says its policy also ensures that each party has an opportunity to fully participate in an investigation and to review evidence before a final determination is reached. ISU says those involved can also appeal.
Support for GLT comes from the Children's Discovery Museum Foundation, presenting the 13th Annual Doctors in Concert Fundraiser, Saturday, April 7th, featuring musical talents of local physicians, hors d'oeuvres, cocktails, and a silent auction. Tickets at childrensdiscoverymuseum.net. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The nation is heading toward an urgent moment in healthcare policy. Okay, a series of such moments, but we're talking about now the need for new ways to care for the elderly. That's the subject of a new book on critical gerontology, edited and in part written by ISU sociologist Chris Wellen. 75 million baby boomers are retiring, and Wellen says they will begin to make claims on social policies, on Medicare and Medicaid and long-term care policies. He says the moment has exposed weaknesses in the policies and our expectations of how life unfolds from independent living to retirement community to assisted living and to long-term care or care at home.
It's not linear, and it's more, the journey is more jagged, because although we talk in an ideal sense about a continuum of care that could link sort of home and community options to more medicalized custodial options like nursing homes, the fact is that in our funding, we've really starved the intermediate part of the continuum. For example, assisted living, which is what is in greatest demand. That's, of course, for people who have some need for support with activities of daily living, but they don't require ongoing skilled nursing care. And the kind of population or census in nursing homes, even with this aging in our society, has remained relatively flat nationally. That's because of people's preferences for and the need for these intermediate settings such as assisted living.
And that's also a policy choice, too. The federal government since 2013, 2014 has been moving to try to keep people in home more.
Yes, in home. And, of course, so when they're in their homes, often it places a great burden on friends and family and neighbors. But to finish the other thought, assisted living in the United States continues to be almost exclusively private pay. And so what we're doing with our public dollars is we are channeling them overwhelmingly toward the most expensive and medicalized options for care, rather than to the especially needed and intermediate options such as assisted living.
Is there any sign that's going to change?
Well, it's like turning a ship around in the ocean. I would say that there are very small incremental changes. They're what is called waiver programs, where states go to the federal government and ask for flexibility to take some of their Medicaid dollars, for example, and channel them away from nursing homes and toward assisted living. And so that's happening. There are sort of pilot waiver programs across the country. In the whole scheme of things, though, that's still a very, very minor part of the picture. And if we don't change it, this is what we think in terms of interesting kind of issues about social change and political advocacy. If we don't begin to reduce the percentage of people who are older or who have chronic disability in nursing homes, it's very soon going to claim almost the entire discretionary state budget of states like Illinois, Ohio, Wisconsin, and others. And so it's really not sustainable. And what we have largely for-profit nursing home industry. About two-thirds of the nursing home beds are for-profit. We have their interests and their lobbying power within Washington pitted against the public good and the public needs of people for long-term care.
Well, we're seeing in the debate over the future of the McLean County nursing home, even this week, that the for-profit sector is not going to take Medicaid beds. It's not going to take the poorest people. It's only going to take those who can pay for it. What is the implication of that?
Well, the government sets reimbursement rates. And if they set them too low, you set the stage for exactly the dilemma that you describe. But what's behind the scenes, and this is part of what we see represented in this book of which I'm part and that I edited, is that American families, ultimately the great majority of them, are going through contortions in their own lives to provide this care in the midst of their paid work and other obligations. And so the notion that any notion that sort of family obligations have retreated, I think, is not supported in any way. It's really quite fanciful. What we see instead is that because of this gap in our social policies, families are going through great efforts to try to provide this care. And ultimately, there's a sort of a very strong gender theme in the book as well, because what we see has to do with the feminization of poverty. women who have historically had the greatest responsibility to provide this care, often they are either cutting back on school or work or leaving work early in order to provide the care at home before nursing home care might be indicated or required. And in so doing, they are jeopardizing their own economic security later in life. And so this is, I think, sort of like a very key sort of political policy and cultural issue of our time, really.
What are the implications for economic growth as a nation if the government continues to deal with it as its policies currently are, and the tension between family obligations and earning one's keep continue to grow?
Wow, that's a complicated question. One aspect of it that I might touch on has to do with that sort of too often invisible army of paid caregivers who are filling in the gap that we've already discussed. About, you know, that gap that family members can't address. So just very briefly, we have, with the baby boomer cohorts, not only a very large cohort, but we have, with the increasing, in a sense, demand for care in later life, we have a decreasing supply because this cohort has had fewer children. More of them are unmarried. About half the baby boomers have experienced a divorce. And so we ask, how are people making it in the United States? In no small part, they're relying on home health aides, certified nursing assistants, and others. And in terms of economic growth and just economic justice, this is perhaps the most numerically large and fastest growing proportionately fastest growing sector of the service economy in the United States today. And yet we still have the vast majority of these workers operating at perhaps only maybe 10, 15%, 20% over minimum wage, mostly working without fringe benefits. And so we have, in a sense, it could be a great opportunity to enrich these jobs and to save public dollars by providing care more cheaply in home and community-based settings. What we've done, however, is nourished the medical long-term care sector at the expense of all of these other needs.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Chris Whelan, an ISU scholar who's an author and editor of a new book on critical gerontology, coming out within the next month and a half. As you noted, the wages for these in-home care people and the front sort of frontline workers tend to be very low. You write in one of the two chapters you author that creates a tension between the qualities needed to exercise high quality care and the economic opportunity. How complex is that level of caregiving?
So in historically, certified nursing assistants, it's right there in the phrase, they took their place in essentially a hierarchical medical division of labor. They were present and are present, of course, for example, in hospital care. In the hospital setting, CNAs, certified nursing assistants, sort of exist at kind of invisibly at the bottom of a hierarchy of kind of medical expertise. They provide an important function, but they are kind of invisible, and we think of their work as essentially very limited, sort of manual, impersonal kinds of tasks. When we shift to home health care or assisted living, of course, then we see the CNA or the home health aide as a central actor in providing care. They're not part of a complex division of labor. And yet, partly because of that legacy of the medical model, we tend to diminish and demean the nature of their work. We see it as essentially bodily work, bodily care, rather than care for the person in a more holistic sense. But what adds to this, critically, has been gender theory, which I mean the work has been seen largely as unskilled because these tasks of nurturance, to the extent that we really think carefully about them, are seen as sort of instinctual for women, capabilities that women just naturally have and as such are not skilled in the sense that, like, a classical economist would regard them.
The emotional intelligence, the need to deal with the person and their emotional needs at the same time you're dealing with their body, and the dignity and the embarrassment that and invasiveness that, that home care often produces.
Precisely, and it also has to do, for example, with monitoring a complicated medical conditions. Their skills have to do with sensitive communication among family members, which is often fraught with conflict.
High emotional intelligence.
High
needed.
Emotional intelligence. They have to know about particular how to read, for example, and support communication that might be impaired by cognitive decline. All of these are aspects of the skill of certified nursing assistants and home health aides.
Are you going to get that skill set with just above minimum wage?
Well, this is an interesting chicken and egg issue. Some of the economic arguments would have it that such workers don't deserve more than minimum wage because, after all, their skills are already sort of in a priori fashion defined as minimal, and they have modest formal credentials. And so another way that we are slowly but surely trying to attack this problem is that the training for CNAs, and some of it goes on, of course, right here in our community, the training has expanded and been enhanced, I think, in some significant ways, and the roles of such workers are being expanded to a certain extent. I'll give you a very brief example of what's called the medical home model. In the medical home model, which is partly an attempt to keep people either out of hospitals or to avoid hospital readmissions, home health aides, generally minimum wage, become kind of the eyes and ears of nurses. They're out in the community, and they can monitor chronic conditions such as diabetes, hypertension, whatever they might be, in a way that allows them to anticipate and prevent more costly medical events. So I think the medical home model is not only the wave of the future with respect to preventative medicine and controlling the inflation and hospital costs, but at the same time, it can be a mechanism for increasing the skills and then, one hopes, the compensation of home health aides.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Chris Whelan is our guest. He's the editor and author of a couple of chapters in a new book on critical gerontology. Is history a guide to how fast policy can change? If we have this semi-truck sized load of baby boomers heading toward retirement and a need for in-home care to remain at least semi-independent for a little longer as they become old and very old. That's a fairly unprecedented event in the nation's history. But is there any sort of guide as to how fast healthcare policy can change that we can use as a crystal ball?
I wish I could be more optimistic about this. We've seen the continued tortured and, I fear, often distorted discourse about the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act has an impact here because, of course, it introduced more preventative care and access to health care earlier, which can, in some sense, avoid what we call the compression of morbidity or the compression of illness later in life. And that there were incentives in the Affordable Care Act, for example, to avoid hospital readmissions, that essentially created a bit of a tide, I think, for enhancing the quality of jobs and training for the workers that we're talking about. But what we see now in the current administration is essentially an attempt to dismantle the Affordable Care Act sort of root and branch. And so we've seemed to take sort of one step forward and a couple of steps back.
Is there not a sign, though, that the policy incentive to take a couple steps back will not entirely take root because healthcare delivery organizations recognize that this is lower cost for them. So they're pushing this continuum of care model themselves now.
I think that, to the extent that there is optimism, one finds this rooted in a kind of convergence or confluence of actors and groups and interests. State governments facing unsustainable Medicaid costs have a very strong incentive to fight back against this narrow lobbying by the nursing home industry. Family members, of course, under our current system, as we all know, in order to qualify for Medicaid, for long-term care, you qualify by virtue of poverty. You have to spend down your assets. So we have middle class or even affluent people in the last years of their lives having to drain their finances, drain their legacy to the next generation in order to sustain their support of vulnerable members of their families. And so they have that interest of the family members. We also have this large group of workers in the service economy. And so there seems to be a sort of triangulation of interest that all point in one direction, Charlie.
This is perhaps beyond your scope, but what are the implications to the maintenance of a strong middle class in the United States with that pressure on families to exhaust income? If there is no generational continuity, you're having to recreate a middle class culture and existence without an asset base.
I couldn't agree more. As we said before, one implication is the continued multi-generational kind of feminization of poverty. And
but in this case, it's not just feminine.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so I think that people, it's kind of an invisible struggle in the sense that, generally speaking, this happens late in people's lives. Family members feel at that point that they're dealing with kind of a very private dilemma, and the system, navigating the system, is really difficult. And so at that point, you know, the great sociologist C. Wright Mills, you know, we inherit this distinction that he gave us back in the late 50s between a private troubles and public issues. I think recently, exactly as with childcare, because almost everything that I've said about care work, low-wage care work, we could insert childcare into that discussion and we'd lose almost nothing. The same assumption of low skills, the same exploitative sort of labor market with very, very high turnover. Okay. It affects sort of the vast majority of families, but there has yet to be a kind of collective political voice that's come to bear. But what you say is absolutely true. I can say from, you know, personal experience and from my expertise right now, high-quality assisted living today in the United States would range anywhere from probably $4,500 to $7,000 a month. Would be at least the $60,000, $70,000 a year could easily exhaust the savings of many middle-class people. And it's a really poignant thing. It's happening all around us, and it's often goes sort of unacknowledged.
If policy were to shift, there is still a problem about quality control and about oversight. These home care workers are operating solo in a lot of ways in addressing a population that is easily exploitable, and family members are not there because they're at their jobs or geographically distant or any number of other things that takes them out of the home as well. How is the public case going to be made for government to pay for this when mechanisms of oversight and the potential for fraud or abuse is pretty high?
I think that potential is real. I think that it is vastly increased and exacerbated when you have such marginal structural labor market conditions. That is, we're talking about people who could work full-time and earn $30,000 a year without any benefits. In such conditions, the potential for resentment or abuse, I think, are a lot higher. So it was interesting, like a small test case in San Francisco. I lived for a time and worked in the Bay Area. They have an in-home supportive service network, which is like a municipal outgrowth of government. And what they did is they essentially moved toward a living wage for in-home supportive workers. These people support either working age or older people in their homes. And they instituted like a significant raise in the income, in the salary structure. And to nobody's surprise, turnover dropped. And so what we have in mind now, and this I touch on this in my own chapter in the book, there are many – what you say is true. The regulations and training vary vastly across states, but there are best practices. We really know people who do this work tend to have a high moral commitment to the work. If you build in something close to a living wage, graduated raises that are tied to things like in-service training and basic fringe benefits that keep people in the jobs, where that's – been where those moves have been instituted, turnover drops, quality and continuity of care are enhanced. And so this, it strikes me like we sort of already know the solution. We're just not following it. There's a group called the Pioneer Network and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has spent millions of dollars studying things. And the research evidence, of which there is a mountain, is really quite persuasive that when you involve frontline care workers in care decisions, when you respect them enough to be part of that team, and when you give them ongoing professional development, turnover falls, quality of care increases. And that, I think, those benefits are what should be sort of like the North Star that we should be following.
Illinois State University Professor of Sociology Chris Wellen says the book is written in an accessible voice. He hopes it will be used by the public and not just policy wonks and students to understand problems in their everyday lives in the context of social policy and demographics. The book, Critical Gerontology, Comes of Age, Advances in Research and Theory for a New Century, is out soon.
Support for GLT comes from the BCPA, presenting award-winning actor Frank Ferrante in his acclaimed portrayal of comedian Groucho Marx, Saturday, April 14th. It's an evening of hilarity and audience participation as Ferrante ad-libs throughout in grand Groucho style. Comedy for all ages. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Democratic nominee for Governor J.B. Pritzker and incumbent Republican Bruce Rauner haven't taken a break from campaigning since winning their respective primaries. Pritzker won in a landslide while Rauner squeaked by his opponent. IPR's Mary Hansen talked with Charlie Wheeler, who says the tight race was no surprise.
There was real discontent with the governor within Republican grassroots ranks for some of the stuff that he did. And to me, the telltale sign that he was worried about it was shortly before the election when he vetoed legislation that had been sent him that would have required registration of gun shop owners. When he did that, it occurred to me he's probably worried. He's trying to solidify his support among the conservative ranks of the party.
The losers of the Democratic primary, State Senator Daniel Biss and Chris Kennedy, they were at a unity breakfast with J.B. Pritzker, who won the Democratic nomination. Are Rauner and State Representative Jeannie Ives getting along in the same way after the primary?
Not that I'm aware of. And I think the attacks on Ives by Rauner portraying her as one of Madigan's puppets, well, I think that really annoyed her very much. And she was very much upset with Rauner for breaking his word to her and other conservative lawmakers that he had assured that he would veto a particular piece of legislation that expanded coverage for elective abortions to Medicaid and state employee group health insurance. And then when he turned around and signed it, I think that was the straw that broke the back, so to speak. And she was not at all conciliatory. One of the things that annoyed Ives and her staff and her supporters, the governor declared himself the victor before the Associated Press or any of the news agencies had. And while some counties had still not reported, usually you don't do that. But she said afterwards, she said she would vote for him because she's a Republican. She will not endorse him. She will not campaign with him. And then a couple of days later, Dave McKinney, reporter for WBEZ, asked Representative Ives, who do you think would be the better governor, Pritzker or Rauner? And Ives hesitated. And finally, after 40 seconds of dead air, she said Rauner. Now that to me is not the kind of wholehearted, 100% behind you support that Senator Biss and Chris Kennedy gave to J.B. Pritzker.
Charlie Wheeler is the director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield. is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Billy Apostle was dubbed Billy Strings at a young age by his mother for his prowess on a number of stringed instruments. Today, the 25-year-old rising bluegrass star, who learned at the feet of his musician father, fronts his own band that plays the Castle Theater in Bloomington tonight. GLT's John Norton caught up with Billy Strings to talk about the musical gifts and influences handed down by his parents.
You can't stop us from putting our lives on the line. You can't stop us from dancing. You can't stop us from feeling high. We can't help it if we'd like to stay out all night.
It's the opening track to the new album from Billy Strings. The song is On the Line from Turmoil in Tinfoil. Joining us on the line from his home in Nashville is Billy Strings. Nice to talk to you, Billy. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. Man, that's kind of a coincidence, huh?
Yeah,
on the line.
Well, we just talked with a young bluegrass band, the Hillbenders, a few weeks ago. They're touring with a bluegrass version of the iconic rock opera Tommy. And when we asked them about it, they said, you know, we respect the past, meaning bluegrass, but we don't want to be tied to it. And it sounds like you have a kind of a similar attitude about the bluegrass you play.
I don't know. I'm trying to learn how to write music. So I think trying to put, you know, not as many boundaries up and kind of let the songs decide where they want to go, you know? I grew up playing traditional bluegrass. You know, it sounds disrespectful if I say kind of something along the lines of that. But it's just a songwriting thing, you know?
But there are some out there that you know, bluegrass traditionalists. I don't know if the tide is changing a little bit, because in blues, there's traditionalists that used to get really upset about new sounds coming in, but they seem to be turning around a little bit now, too.
Yeah, well, I wonder that. You know, I wonder if the old school heads, you know, maybe they thought Johnny Winter was too loud.
Yeah.
Or something. I wasn't around, so I never got to go to those shows, but, I wonder that. We're all playing bluegrass. You know, Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys, they're the trunk of the tree. And then on up, you got some branches up there, like Newgrass Revival and some more progressive stuff, you know, seldom seen. It's funny. I was talking to Brian Sutton the other day, and we were talking about seldom seen over lunch. And, you know, it's just kind of funny how long ago that band was kind of hitting it, and that they're still considered progressive bluegrass.
Well, and you are incorporating different sounds, whether it's kind of a psychedelic sound, more rock sound, more other kinds of sounds. Was this something that just kind of came naturally from all the music you were listening to growing up? Or is this something you go, maybe, you know, I got to start doing some of this. Maybe it'll sound better.
I think it's a little of both. You know, I think it's me wanting to incorporate some of those other inspirations that I have, you know, the Grateful Dead and Jimi Hendrix, and I mentioned Johnny Winter you know, whatever I've listened to my entire life, including metal bands and stuff like that. But I started out with bluegrass, so that's always going to be in there. But it's just sort of trying to figure out where I'm heading. And also, if you just follow your heart and kind of follow the songs or whatever artistic direction you're heading without trying to sound like Bill Monroe, you know, it might set you aside some other bluegrass bands that, you know, sort of all sound the same.
Sure. Billy Strings, our guest, talking to us from his home in Nashville. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Billy, you came out right out of the chute with the second song on the album Turmoil and Tinfoil, Meet Me at the Creek, at 9.5 minutes long. And it's about water. Meet Me at the Creek, about water. And you grew up in Traverse City, Michigan. You spent a lot of time there. You also grew up on a river in another part of Michigan. Doesn't it seem like great music comes from people being near rivers?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely something there. There was this old train trestle that was, you know, abandoned years and years ago. But when I was a little kid, we used to go play down there. And my dad also took us fishing down there when we were little. You know, when I was growing up a little bit, you know, in my preteens, and, you know, when I was 12 or 13 years old, when I thought break up with some high school girlfriend or something, and I thought my whole world was over or whatever, but I'd go sit down by that river. And I'd just think, and I'd just watch the muddy water go by, and kind of, it would help me meditate, you know. And I'd sometimes bring my fishing pole and catch a few smallmouth or whatever, but sometimes I'd just go down there and sit. And so I kind of, when I wrote this song, I was kind of thinking about that place that I used to go chill.
Thank you.
forgetting about the days I left behind.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton talking with Billy Strings, who's at the Castle Theater in downtown Bloomington tonight. And I mentioned a couple of places in Michigan you've lived in, but you also spent a little bit of time in Kentucky. Michigan doesn't seem to be a place where bluegrass would spring out of. Kentucky might seem more like that. But was it more about your dad, though, and his playing and picking when you were growing up?
Yeah, you know, when I lived in Kentucky, I was a baby. I can't even remember living in Moorhead, you know, because we moved up to Michigan when I was still a baby. But my dad, he raised me on Doc Watson's music and Bill Monroe, all of it, Lester Flatt, Meryl Scruggs, Jimmy Martin, Larry Sparks, and Stanley Brothers and all that. But my parents also, they love the Beatles. They love Hendrix. They love Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Johnny Winter, Yes, King Crimson, you know, like all these kind of old rock and roll bands, you know, Edgar Winter. My mom's a huge Johnny Winter fan, and Pink Floyd, and just all of it, you know. So it was basically, I think my parents liked good music. And so when I was a kid, man, I was exposed to a lot of this, you know.
Well, I mean, in a lot of that could sort of stifle some kids. You heard about the sports parents who push their kid into football or baseball or basketball, and they just don't want to do it. But it sounds like it was kind of a feast for you. You must have really, really enjoyed hearing all this music and really took to it quickly.
Man, my parents are really cool. You know, they listen to good music, and they taught me about. You know, when I was little, they taught me about bluegrass. And then when I got old enough, they taught me about, like, the whole hippie culture. And, you know, like I said, I learned about Woodstock, and I learned about the Kool-Aid tests, and I learned about the Grateful Dead, and I learned, you know, about tie-dye and growing my hair out, and electric guitar. And, you know, because that's what they were doing when they were my age, man. They were hippies, you know?
Oh, I could never love another.
These Memories of You is the song you're hearing. It's from the new album by Billy Strings called Turmoil and Tinfoil. This is GLT Sound Ideas. Turmoil and Tinfoil is the name of the album, but it's also a song on the album. And if I have this right, it's you describing someone who's standing right in front of you, but you're missing that person. And if you've ever had a friend who's addicted to hard drugs, you might know what I'm talking about. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, it could be hard drugs. It could be, you know, anything. It's like kind of just about somebody who's lost, you know, and maybe you're trying to help them, but they just kind of don't. I don't know. You know, it's kind of hard to explain.
Did you have a friend who was having that problem?
I've had lots of them, man. I grew up in a tiny little town where there wasn't nothing to do. So by the time we were in middle school, you know, we were trying stuff. You know, we were experimenting. A lot of my friends went down the wrong road. They got, you know, locked up, overdosed, suicide. I lost a lot of friends to drugs, man.
Through the turmoil and the tinfoil, I could wait my early life. I could see you in the darkness, and I'm running through the night. Silver morning, when your face had turned to gray, you were standing right before me, but I missed you every day.
You've been playing music from a really young age, and now that you're a professional musician, first of all, did you always want to be a professional touring musician? And what's the reality like now versus the fantasy of what you thought it might be like before you start heading out on the road and doing it full time?
Yes, I've always wanted to. You know, when I was a kid, I used to read books about Janis Joplin and like, you know, biographies of these huge idols and these huge musical icons, Nirvana and like Kurt Cobain, and I used to read books about Jim Morrison. And so, yeah, when I was a kid, I did kind of have this dream of, you know, this like rock star kind of dream. It's very different now. It's not like that kind of fantasy at all. It's really, I'm a working musician, you know. I do 200 gigs a year, and I'm out there on tour, on the road all the time.
But it isn't so different. You know, I'm traveling with a group of friends, and we're the best friends anybody could have, and we're experiencing all these amazing things together on the road, and we're making so many friends, and it's just a beautiful experience to be able to travel, see the country, do all these shows, go play in all these venues, these magical music venues that, you know, hundreds of other bands have caressed throughout the years. It's just really an honor, really, and also to become friends with, you know, people that I've grown up admiring and kind of worshiping my whole life. You know, people like David Grisman and Sam Bush and Del McCurry. And, you know, these people are my friends now. They're not just my heroes. They're still my heroes, but they're also my friends. It's incredible. You know, I never thought I'd be able to do this. And I've just had an enormous amount of support and encouragement from, you know, my friends. That it's just been, it's been a wild ride, man. And it's just beginning, really.
GLT's John Norton speaking with Billy Strings, who plays the Castle Theater tonight in downtown Bloomington. Doors open at 7 p.m., show at 8. You can also hear Billy Strings' music on GLT's Acousticity, the best in folk, bluegrass, and Celtic music, tonight at 7 on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. You can find more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews with help today from John Norton, Ryan Denham, and Laura Kennedy. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or call. Leave a message about the show at 309-438-WGLT. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.